This afternoon, as we continue our perspectives on the Holocaust, we are going to think about the Holocaust through perhaps the eyes of the late Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. Rabbi Soloveitchik was one of the most significant, influential, important, impactful Jewish personalities of the 20th century. Today is not the time to go through an entire extensive biography or bibliography of Rabbi Soloveitchik's life and teachings. He grew up in Eastern Europe as the brilliant rabbinic, luminary, already at a young age, who was the torchbearer of a rabbinic dynasty known as the Soloveitchik family on his father's side. His father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, his grandfather, Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik, his great-grandfather, Rabbi Yosef Dov HaLevi Soloveitchik, after whom he was named.
They were Levies?
They were all Levies, yes. So they were Levies. They were significant rabbinic personalities. Rabbi Chaim Soloveitchik transformed Talmudic study in Eastern Europe. His mother's family was also a significant rabbinic family. Their name was Feinstein. Her father was Rev Elia from the family of Rev Elia Pruzhiner. He himself arrived in the United States, fast forward, after having achieved greatness in Torah and also a PhD from the University of Berlin in philosophy. He comes to America after not landing a position in Europe that he was interested in, comes to America, early 1930s, settles in Boston, becomes the chief rabbi overseeing kashrus and communal affairs. He becomes the Rosh Yeshiva, the dean of the rabbinical school of Yeshiva University, of Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elkanan, after the passing of his late father, Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, in 1941. And he goes on to ordain thousands of rabbis and shape the entire American and world Jewish community. Passes away in 1933. He had two daughters, one of whom is the wife of the late Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, famous rabbinic personality, passed away probably about 6 years ago, 6 or 7 years now, Rav Aaron Lichtenstein.
Passed away in 1933. It was
like 93. Yes. Yeah. He passed away in 1993. His other son-in-law was the late Harvard professor, Rabbi Dr. Isidore Twersky, also known as the Toler Rebbe. And his son, Professor Chaim Soloveitchik, is a well-known historian. So that's just the long and the short of it. But to understand that Rav Soloveitchik's writings and thought have shaped literally generations of rabbis, Jews, communities, individuals, there is a treasure trove of manuscripts that have been published, which we'll reference in a little bit. They are published under this group called Me'otzar HaRav. You can get these books at a local bookstore. You can get them anywhere online. These are Rabbi Soloveitchik's manuscripts of his own writings that he delivered as oral talks and then kept in a closet after he passed away. They published them. He wrote several volumes of his own, and many of his students have published many of his talks. But he's really one of the most significant figures in Jewish thought in the past 100 years. And this is a man who experienced the Holocaust in America through his own life, especially keep in mind that many of the people, family members, friends, acquaintances, Talmudic interlocutors, were people who were killed in the Holocaust. But during the Holocaust, he is in America. I want to think today with you through the lens, through the eyes of Rabbi Soloveitchik at the Holocaust with four different perspectives. One perspective that we could argue for looking at the Holocaust through the eyes of Rabbi Soloveitchik is do something. We know that in 1943, there was a rally in Washington of rabbis. If you follow on the screen, this is the David S. Wyman Institute for Holocaust Studies. So Rafi Medoff has a letter here that was written by a very well-known historian, Arthur Hertzberg. He was later rabbi in Baltimore. That's why growing up in Baltimore, there was a shul. It was just called Hertzberg's, as is commonplace in many Jewish communities. So this is a letter from Rabbi Hertzberg about his father, that this rally in Washington, right before Yom Kippur in 1943, actually began the Thursday before. And he writes, the primary observance was in Baltimore because there was no adequate Orthodox synagogue in Washington in those days, and no community of Orthodox families which could house these rabbis for the Sabbath. Dozens of the most notable figures who were alumni of the leading yeshivas in Europe took part in the prayers which launched this weekend of imploring God and the political leaders to defend and save the Jews under Nazi rule. I was a youngster of 22 who was allowed to be present because the leaders, men who were older than me by a generation or two, were friends and contemporaries of my father, Rabbi Tzvi Elimelech Hertzberg. I saw their tears and heard their sobs. They were standing before God and praying for the life and safety of people who were their brothers and who could have been themselves. I cried among them and I could not stop, not that day and nor for many days to come. On Sunday morning, I was given a seat in one of the cars that drove 40 miles from Baltimore to Washington. This was a different kind of rabbinic gathering. These rabbis were not clean-shaven or well-dressed. They were avowedly East European. They represented not, quote, American types from the posh synagogues. On the contrary, they might just as well have been the rabbis whom Hitler was then putting in death camps along with their congregants. They were standing at the gate of the White House begging the president to see them and to do something for the Jews who were being slaughtered by the tens of thousands. I could not get up to the fence of the White House, so I had to look on from the park across the road. Eventually, someone came out of the White House. He took a letter from the rabbis to the president, but the president himself never greeted them. We were soon told that several of his Jewish advisors had told FDR that these immigrant rabbis were not the official leaders of the Jewish community, etc., and you see further. You can read more about this institute, this episode, and see the pictures on your own on this website, but I will show you this is a document of the partial list of rabbis who attended that day, and you will note that there are some significant names that maybe you are familiar with, like Moses Feinstein on the left side, and what is extremely meaningful to me is that if you look on the right side, I'm going to make it slightly bigger, if you can see. Hold on. You see this where the arrow is? M. Kovalenko. That is shorthand for Melech Kovalenko, my great-grandfather. My mother's father, his name was Ben Koval Zichrono Levracha. Koval was his shortened name for Kovalenko. His father was a Rav in a town called Astropolia before they came to America. Rav Elimelech Kovalenko Zecher Tzadok Levracha was my mother's father's father. He traveled to Washington with this group. He's part of the picture. I have a cousin who likes to keep this picture. It's difficult to pick him out because it's a giant sea of white beards and black coats and black hats. But this is a very well-known event. It was covered widely in the press. You can find the minutes of the events that took place, the people whom they met with. There's a lot of information which is here.
So, what year was it?
This was 1943, right before Yom Kippur.
I think my Rabbi Aaron
Ryan. They don't have the full list here. It doesn't go down to R. That he was there. So the first thing to note is that, yes? So many of these members were the heads of and very active in the Vahdat Sala. Who? This was at the same time. It's contemporaneous. It's the same time these people are active. This is part of the Vahdat Sala's activities. One of the co-leaders of this mission of the Agudas HaRabbanim was Rabbi Lazer Silver, Zecher Tzadok Levracha, the head of this Igor HaRabbanim, the Council of Rabbis. He was very active in the Vahdat Sala. So it's kind of the same thing, and we're not going to get into today to the political issues that Professor Hertzberg alluded to, that there were certain rabbis, primarily not Orthodox rabbis, who whispered in the ear of the people in Washington that these guys, they don't represent the Jewish community. And this is a very painful and sad episode in Jewish history. So there are more books and things to read about this. David Weinman wrote a book. Rabbi Lookstein, shall live and be well, wrote a book called Am I My Brother's Keeper? About the American Jewish response. There's a lot to say about this episode. But what I want to take away the first is that even though his name is not on this list, many of the rabbis who attended were not on the list because they just didn't sign up. Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik attended this rally. It's the first thing when a person is experiencing something like the Holocaust going on in the world, lo and behold, we should never know anything from that. But Rabbi Soloveitchik's first way of looking at this is, do something. Go to Washington and rally. That's the first response. Fast forward many years later, and there's a counterpoint to this. And what you're going to hear now is an audio from a talk that Rabbi Soloveitchik delivered on December 24th, 1973, at the Wurzweiler School of Social Work. You're going to hear his picture. You're going to see his picture, excuse me, and you're going to hear his voice. I hope the audio is going to work. Let's make sure it does. Rabbi Soloveitchik is speaking and reflecting on the Holocaust. And remember, now early 70s. Sigismund. The brother of Rabbi Aaron Soloveitchik.
American Jews did not react properly. You could have saved many. Of course, you know, Roosevelt was no good in the State Department and they submitted his secretary, Cordell Hull. I mean, but we did not exert any pressure. Not exert any pressure. Not at all. I mean, when I say Chatos in not only regard to the American Jews, in regard to myself. Somebody suggested to me, and he's right, that in the Al-Chet, Yom Kippur, should a new Al-Chet should be included. It is true. But American Jews react differently now. There is more courage. There is not a frightened immigrant anymore. There is an American. There is more courage. There is more chutzpah. There is the quality of traitors begins to show as far as the American Jewish community is concerned.
What is Rabbi Soloveitchik saying? He's saying that he personally feels that he's to take some responsibility to say Al-Chait on Yom Kippur, that we didn't do enough. So perspective number one is do something. And perspective number two is after the fact, if we didn't do enough, to be honest. Dr. Medoff has an essay where he points out that in the early 70s, nobody wanted to talk about this. Nobody wanted to say that the American Jews didn't do enough. Rabbi Soloveitchik said, we got to be honest. We have to acknowledge what we did and what we didn't do. That's the second akuda, is that when we reflect, we have to be honest. A third perspective through the eyes of Rabbi Soloveitchik is really fascinating. We alluded before that many of his talks were written in manuscript form and put in a cabinet in his home in Boston. And this is a collection of talks related to the holidays of Purim and Hanukkah called Days of Deliverance, Essays on Purim and Hanukkah. And at the beginning, they give you the sources from where he was drawn. This chapter that we're going to read from is primarily from a manuscript of a lecture that was delivered on Hanukkah in 1974, as well as selections from a manuscript of a memorial lecture from 1977 and a drasha in 1978. So they put together the pieces from his writings with a thematic collation. So in this chapter, Rabbi Soloveitchik is reflecting on the Rambam, Maimonides, and the way that he categorized the holiday of Hanukkah as a response to the Seleucid Greek oppression and what that oppression exactly was. And Maimonides takes pains to describe in detail in what ways Antiochus persecuted the Jews, not just religiously, but also socially. And Rav Soloveitchik is discussing this, kind of amplifying and explaining this Rambam. The Rambam has a line about Pashtu Yadam Bimamonam Ubivnoseim, that the Greeks stretched their hands out against the Jews' property and against their daughters, their women. So Rav Soloveitchik has the preceding section here of what it means, the dignity of Jewish women. Then he describes the following. He says, usually our enemies knew what to attack. They had a satanic intuition and assaulted our central institutions. And so he describes this context of persecution. During the Second Commonwealth, it was the Sabbath and circumcision that were disliked by the Greeks and Romans. At the time of the Hasmoneans, our enemies attacked the temple, as Maimonides emphasizes. They entered the temple, made breaches in it, and defiled what that was pure. Our enemies understood well that at that time, we could not have survived as a people without the temple. That was what united the entire people, from the farmers of the Galilee to the workers of Jerusalem. However, and remember, this is Rav Soloveitchik delivering a talk, so you can hear that cadence, that kind of faulty, broken English. However, during the 200 years after the Hasmonean victory, we developed the ability to survive in exile without a temple, as Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai realized when he requested Yavne over Jerusalem. Later, in the Middle Ages, the church hated the Talmud, which had become the symbol of Jewish uniqueness. Now the object of hatred is the state of Israel. The anti-Semite cannot simply attack a Jew. He needs a certain object of hate. So this is the story. Yes?
Roughly what year was that written?
This is early 70s, 1974. But now he writes something really interesting, and I think this is the third set of eyes that Rav Soloveitchik puts on the Holocaust, now in the 70s. We have lost many. Not so long ago, we lost 6 million Jews, one-third of our population. But, and again, this is the same person who said, Al Chait, I was wrong, but, he says, he's not being callous, but this is what he says, but on the whole, we have emerged victorious. We still retain our identity. We are still committed to the same goals to which our ancestors were committed millennia ago, and we still assemble and study Torah. And now he quotes the verse about angel, the wrestling with the angel. And there wrestled a man with him until the break of the day. We do not see daybreak yet, but the morning star will finally rise. So the third perspective of Rav Soloveitchik is to see that even though there was such terrible destruction, but that the spiritual dynamic, the narrative, the Jewish identity, that was not destroyed. When we go through this entire Holocaust narrative, where do we end? Not with, okay, the Germans, they wiped out the people, and then the end of the story, we move to somebody else. The Greeks are gone. And the Romans are gone, but the Jews are still here. And quite the opposite. The Jews have a state. They have a thriving society. It's not perfect, but it's certainly an aspiring, it's a journey toward the ideal Jewish values. It's certainly animated with many Jewish characters. It's, I think, if I'm not mistaken, you could tell me if you disagree, but I think it is a fact that the state of Israel is the largest supporter of Torah study in the history of the Jewish people. No single benefactor has ever supported as many people for as long, like 74 years of supporting Torah study in Israel, kollelim, yeshivas, avreichim, younger light. It's amazing. We should not take that for granted. So Rav Soloveitchik is saying, let's also put it in context. That when we think about the destruction, we also realize that post that destruction, we survived. And this is something that we've talked about in terms of at the time that people were experiencing the Holocaust, they still maintained so much of this spiritual identity. So it's not focusing with the eyes on the physical destruction exclusively, it's also looking at the spiritual dimension. And that spiritual dimension was not destroyed. From that we have emerged victorious. That's element number three. So it's number one, do something. Number two, take responsibility. Be accountable. Number three, look at it with a spiritual set of eyes. And then number four, probably the most well-known and the most fundamental treatment that Rav Soloveitchik gave us on the Holocaust is that at the outset of the talk which he gave on Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israel Independence Day 1956 in New York, where he delivered a talk known as Kol Dodi Dofeik, the voice of my beloved is knocking. Oh, thank you so much. The voice of my beloved. What's that? Oh, thank you. Baruch Atah Adonai Elohim Melech Olam Shachol Nivivaro. Yes. Kol Dodi Dofek. The voice of my beloved is knocking. This speech is most well known for the fact that Rav Soloveitchik enumerates at great length what he calls the six knocks that God knocked on our door with the founding of the State of Israel. And so this, it's been translated, by the way, in a book called Fate and Destiny. Rav Soloveitchik originally published it himself in Hebrew, called Kol Dodi Dofek, which is one of the few things that he himself published in his lifetime, which obviously attests to the significance with which he viewed this teaching, this Torah, this very fundamental yesod, this fundamental principle. The majority of it is well known and talked about in terms of the end, which is the bulk of the talk, which relates to Israel and how God is knocking on our door and the gift of the State of Israel, what those six knocks are. But the prelude to that is a substantive section on the Holocaust. And that's where he begins. So you don't need to buy the book. You can go online and find this here on Sefaria, S-E-F-A-R-I-A, which is what you're looking at on the screen. The beginning is, the section begins, Kol Dodi Dofek, the righteous suffer. One of the deepest mysteries troubling Judaism from the dawn of its existence is the problem of suffering. So this is the first section where he deals with suffering generally. In addition to this, if you want more on Rabbi Soloveitchik and his treatment of suffering from a theological, from a Jewish standpoint, take a look at one of those Me'otzer HaRav volumes called Out of the Whirlwind. That's also easily accessible. It's an English collection of talks. So he says, in the beginning, this idea is the question of suffering. Once upon a time, years ago, we dealt with a piece of this, which I'm not going to focus on today, the difference between the existence of fate and the existence of destiny. You remember this? We had a whiteboard on this side of the room. We created two columns, fate being passive, leaving, being taken out of Egypt, destiny being active, having a role, creating a covenant at Sinai. That's the first section of this. This is the difference between the existence of fate and destiny. And now he talks about evil and the fact that in Judaism, with its realistic approach to man and his status within existence, understood that evil does not lend itself to being obscured and glossed over. Meaning, we don't pretend that evil does not exist. People make choices, and some of those choices are evil. And we remember that at least every year. For some people, it's every day. There are, at the end of the davening in the morning, there are six zechiros, six things that we remember. One of those things that we remember is what Amalek, the epitome, the personification, the expression of evil, what Amalek did to us. So we acknowledge that there is something called evil, that there is that phenomenon in the world, and we don't hide from it. Oh, I do want to add, I should have mentioned this at the beginning, that our learning today should be in the merit of a refuah shleima of Maria Shehena Bas Dova. She should have a refuah shleima. Evil, says Rav Soloveitchik, is a fact, and that cannot be denied. There is evil in the world. There are suffering and agony and death pangs. He who would deceive himself by ignoring the split in existence and by romanticizing life is but a fool and a fabricator of illusions. So the question is, okay, so how do we think about that? Says Rav Soloveitchik, skipping ahead, now section 8 you see here on the screen. In short, the eye of fate asks a speculative metaphysical question about evil, and this question is not given to solution and has no answer. We could characterize this person of fate, this passive posture, asking the question, why? Why? Has anybody here ever received a prophecy from God telling you why? Why parents sometimes, lo aleinu, have to see a child suffer, why people experience difficulties, challenges, why people suffer loss. Anybody ever tell you why? No. I've shared with you before that there was a man that some of you knew. He was 52 years old, and at the place of employment where he worked, which has about 55,000 employees, I would say, he was in the top 10. And he became ill with a very devastating ailment. And I had the great schus, you know, in those days especially, I didn't have so much gray in my beard. So, you know, I was a kid, but I used to talk to him and sit with him and listen to him and keep him company. Obviously, I had no insight. I certainly wouldn't have any insight today. I certainly didn't have any insight then. A person who's mamish suffering. And I'm not sure if he knew at that time. He was diagnosed with this ailment around Rosh Hashanah. I didn't know, and I don't know if he knew, and I'm not sure how many people in the family knew that it was going to be Rosh Chodesh Adar Beis, that was going to be the end of his journey in this world. And at the beginning, he used to ask the question a lot, why? Why did God do this? And he used to ask why and why. But what was interesting is that he stopped asking that question after a certain point. Because he didn't get any answers. It wasn't very productive. It didn't build him up. It didn't help him. But Rav Soloveitchik says there's a second way of looking at this issue of suffering. In the second dimension of man's existence, destiny, the question of suffering takes on a new form. What is an existence of destiny? It is an active existence. When man confronts the environment into which he has been cast with an understanding of his uniqueness and value, freedom and capacity, the slogan of Eye of Destiny is, against your will you are born and against your will you will die, but by your free will do you live. Man is born as an object, dies as an object, but is within his capability to live as a subject. Skipping ahead. According to Judaism, man's mission in this world is to turn fate into destiny, an existence that is passive and influenced into an existence that is active and influential.
Can I ask a question?
Sure, ask a question.
Okay, that confused me a little bit.
Yeah.
To change our fate into destiny.
Yes.
Isn't that kind of one and the same?
So his difference between fate and destiny is that fate is a passive why. I am fated to something means I am sitting here doing nothing, being transported, carried, moved, positioned, placed. Destiny is I'm in a circumstance and I take the initiative to create, to forge a path, to navigate, to manipulate the circumstance that I'm in. It's moving from asking why to asking what. That is the crucial distinction. Rav Soloveitchik is saying there's a shift from why to what. And this is what I heard from this gentleman, Rav Hillel Michel, Zichrono Livracha, that he stopped talking about why after a couple months. And he used to instead of asking why, he would say, okay, so what do I do now? Do I need to start thinking about giving more charity? Do I need to think about speaking to people about faith? Do I need to spend more time with my family? It's a question of what, says Rav Soloveitchik. What do I do now? If you think about so many of the stories that we have explored over the past, I don't know if you can think about it this way, but we've been together now for 7 years, many of us, learning, being on this journey. 7 years. How many of these stories are about people whose fate, quote-unquote, landed them in the most horrific circumstances, but instead of asking why, which some of them did for a while, and that they asked what? What can I do to help the next person? What do I need to think about? Yes, go ahead.
I was going to say, it's become very popular now with Edith Eger's book, The Choice, because she grasped that same idea. Like,
totally.
It happened to me. It's logotherapy, whatever, Viktor Frankl. So this is the religious
yes.
piece of it, but that's kind of the mainstream, the same idea. Like, this happened. I can't change that it happened, but I have a choice of what am I doing?
Like, exactly.
Well, how do I take that and how do I act on it?
Exactly. What do I do? Yeah, sure.
In response to what the example you gave of a friend that died early and prematurely and not very well. To me, fate is something is beyond our control. Fate is something that we came to this into this world not knowing what the output was and how the degree of it impacts us. Whereas destiny is something that we can do something about.
That is yes. That is precisely what the Rav is saying. You don't have a choice in fate. Right? The Gemara has an expression. Hakol bidei shamayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven. Chutz miyiras shamayim. What does that mean? Chutz miyiras shamayim, except for fear of heaven. What does it mean when the Talmud teaches that God controls everything except he gives us the fear of heaven? What that means is God controls all the circumstances in which we find ourselves.
But
what's the second half? What does it mean, Yira Shamayim? It means moral decisions. Anything in your life that has a spark of holiness, that is in your yad, it's in your hands. That's not Bidei Shamayim. God doesn't pull strings as a puppeteer for your life. He gives you a life. He controls that. He controls whether a person, Lo Aleinu, would be ill or be healthy, will live a long life or a short life, whether they'll have emotional stability or emotional challenges, whether they'll be tall or short or whatever. God creates all of that. We don't get a say. But what we get a say in is in the Yira Shamayim, in the moral, ethical choices that we make. So if a person is short, so they, you know, they can easily sneak under the sink. And if they're tall, so one of the benefits of being 6 feet tall is that when my grandmother, Lahashalom, when I would visit her in Yerushalayim, so I could reach the bottom. You know, there's stuff in the crawl space. So one of my great schuyas, she was, I don't want to say how tall she was. She wasn't, maybe she was tall. She was tall-ish for a short Polish woman. Maybe she was 5'4" or something like that. She was so beloved to me. And so that was, so the point is, it's not about the situation in which you are. It's what are you doing with it? That is the key.
But our beliefs teach us that we have options, good or bad.
Yes.
We have the ability to control those.
That's exactly it. So Rav Soloveitchik is saying that, and that's what the Gemara is saying. Rav Soloveitchik is saying that is a life of destiny. That is what he says right now. The halachic answer to this question is very simple, so that the suffering, it's essentially, it gives us an opportunity. From negation sprouts affirmation. From antithesis, thesis emerges. From a denial of existence, a new existence is revealed. It's not running away from God. Rather, we take this idea. Judaism made this notion more profound when it combined the idea of the repair, tikkun of evil, and its elevation with the perfection and elevation of goodness. So it's up to us. This is the key. This is what Rav Soloveitchik wants us to know. Yes.
I would just say, when you're talking about living with moral choice, and that's our destiny, which is absolutely circles us back to your beginning of evil in the world, because evil is the choice of man, right?
Yes.
And so it's hard for us to understand that evil is God's given free will to choose, right? And so you're saying that, you know, like when you circle back, so the destiny is, and then it's therefore hopefully making that correct moral decision, and
if you didn't. So now we come back, and so of course the next piece of Rav Soloveitchik is that saying is, okay, God says, I'm going to give you the state of Israel. What are your decisions now? How are you going to respond as individuals, as a community? But now we can think about this fourth frame, and of course the next section here immediately, which we're not going to go into today, talks about Job, Eov, who has all of these terrible divine sufferings, and the back and forth in that conversation. Rabbi Soloveitchik is telling us that when we study the Holocaust and when we teach the Holocaust, if we take a theological perspective that says why, which initiates some kind of a crisis of faith, then we're never going to get out of that black hole. Because nobody can ever explain to you why God would allow 1.5 million children to be brutally, indescribably, horribly killed. No one can explain why. And if anybody ever thinks that they can explain why, I just advise you run the other way as fast as you possibly can. It's indescribable, the why. Who's going to tell you why? This question of suffering, it dates back all the way to Moses. There's a whole literature, there's a whole world of Torah study on theodicy, and now it's called, as it relates to the Holocaust, Shoahology. That Moses, he came to God, according to the Talmud, he says, I want to understand. God says, you can't understand. I can't tell you why in this world. I can't tell you why. It's my business, not your business. So Rav Soloveitchik says, what do we make of this then? The answer is, it's asking what? What happens now? It's interesting that, remember, he began with this quick allusion to fate and destiny, the Exodus, being in Egypt versus getting out of Egypt. It's not clear why it is that we were enslaved in Egypt. That's not 100% clear. The Talmud has multiple answers. Anytime there's multiple answers to something, that means that usually the question's a really good question, and each of those answers, not a great answer. So we don't know exactly why we went down to Egypt. But the Torah tells us that we went down to Egypt, that we were in Egypt. It tells us 22 times. You know why it keeps reminding us 22 times? It says, make sure you treat a stranger properly. It counts, I think she says, 22 times. It says, how do you treat another person? Because you were in Egypt. So the fate question about Egypt says, why did we go to Egypt? God says, that's not a halachic question. It's not a productive question. It's a question, you can ask it. We ask it on Tisha B'Av, and there are different approaches that are given. Just like in theodicy, there are different Masorah approaches. But that doesn't really help. What helps, what's for a halachic, for a Jew who wants to know what to do and how to live? The answer is the question of what. What do you do now? You went through an Egypt experience, so you know what you do now? You're sensitive to somebody else. You saw people on a boat off the harbor from Cuba, bobbing there for weeks, and then get sent back to Hamburg. You saw the St. Louis? You saw that? So what do you do now when you see refugees? The halacha question is what? That's really the key. So to summarize, perhaps, and I'm not expert on anything, certainly not on the thought of Rav Soloveitchik, but I think that there are four takeaways that Rav Soloveitchik gives us through his perspective on the Holocaust. Number one is, when you have an opportunity, do something. Be active. Number two, when you look back and you're honest about it, take responsibility. Number three, think about it from a spiritual perspective and understand that even though, of course, there was immense, immeasurable destruction, but as a Jewish people, from a spiritual standpoint, both during and after the Holocaust, we were not destroyed. We will, and we have, and we will continue to write that Jewish story, to continue that divine narrative. And finally, when people are asking and thinking, you know, why did God and where was God? We don't know where was God and we don't know why was God. But we do know that given that we, that this experience, we collectively have this seared on our souls, we know that we have to ask the question of what? What do we need to do as the heirs of this story? What elements do we need to keep telling? How do we behave? What do we need to do to perpetuate the legacy and the memories of the people who are gone, of the communities, of lives, the whole world that was? The question is not why. It's not that it's not a fair question. It is a fair question, but it's not a productive question. The question, when you finish your tours, when we finish reading a book, when we finish thinking about and reflecting on these people, the question is what? That's what Rav Soloveitchik wants to take away, and that's why I think this is a very, very important Torah for us as students and for all of you who are teaching in the world of Holocaust education. It's the spiritual question, the halachic question of what do we do with the learning, the teaching, the study, the experience of the Holocaust.